And that jarring cacophony tells you that, once again, you're back with the Power of Three podcast. We are counting down the days till the new series arrives, and we're not far away now. It's day 10 of our run as we get ready for the new series with Shudigatwa. This song's not catching on.
What is this song? You've been singing it every day for the last week and a half, and I don't know what it is. What is it? What is it from originally? Or is it just something?
It's the Willy Wonka song from the
You did say that at the start. I'd obviously blanked it out. Anyway.
Yeah, it's too exciting. Anyway, that doesn't matter. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm David Steele. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. Day 10 means it's the 10th Doctor. The book we're covering today is The Doctor Trap by Simon Messiaen. And we're delighted to say we have a special guest joining us live today. Special guest, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I am Simon Messiaen. I'm a special guest.
Hey!
Woo! Woo! It's something good old TFI Friday.
We've all crowded into my whole cupboard to record this episode this morning. If everyone's got enough room, just about, we're okay.
Yeah, it's bigger on the inside, Dave. Reminds me of something else, but that's an outtake from another day. Anyway, hello, Simon. How are you?
I'm jolly good, and I'm glad we're in a cupboard because I feel about as far from Scotland as it's possible to be in the UK, so it is like a TARDIS. Yes, no, I'm very good, thank you. Lovely to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you. We're here to chat about The Doctor Trap, which was, of course, the 26th novel in the BBC New Series Adventures range with The Tenth Doctor and Donna. And scarily, it was published on the 4th of September 2008, along with Shining Darkness and Ghosts of India, which is quite scary when you think it was that long ago. And it was then followed by a release as an audiobook on the 12th of March 2009, which was read by Russell Tovey. Before we go on, let's have a quick excerpt from that.
The Doctor's impish face looked down from the air screen. He smirked as if taunting the hunters. "Oh, come on," said Sebastian. "Surely somebody wants a pop." Sebastian realised they were afraid. He walked around the perfect table. "Should you succeed, you will succeed where hundreds, thousands of others have failed. The Endangered Dangerous Species Society will live in eternity."
"And if we fail?"
rasped a metallic voice, the semblance of Draxix, speaking from his armoured carapace. "If you fail, then I get to hunt you," Sebastian replied. "Come on. Surely someone can bag him. Fair game." He blinked, and the air screen changed picture to a digital map, areas divided by fizzing blue lines. "Hunting zones. One for each of you, tailored to your individual chosen environments. The Doctor will land at random in one of your zones. From then, it's up to you. Should a hunter miss and survive, Planet One would transmit the Doctor to another random zone, and we start again. If the Doctor is killed, I will return the remaining hunters to your home planet, with considerable compensation for your time and effort, of course." Brutus let out a bellow of such raw rage that the whole room was silenced. Even Sebastian was surprised. The simian held his chair away and beat his chest.
"Enough! I will have no part of this madness! The Doctor cannot be vanquished by mortal hand. This is written in our holiest book. I leave now."
He pointed a giant fist at Sebastian.
"Do not try to stop me, powdered fop."
"Wouldn't dream of it," said Sebastian. Brutus stomped to the back of the conference room. Gilt-framed double doors opened as he approached. The simian sneered at his fellow hunters.
"The Doctor! He will kill you all!"
Sebastian pointed. Bright light flashed from his hand and with a loud pop incinerated Brutus. The soft sunlight caught the ashes drifting to the floor.
"Impressive,"
said the Carpalian witch. But you did say you wouldn't dream of stopping him. Sebastien looked coolly at his hand. Whoops! Anyone else bursting to go?
I've never heard it.
Have you not?
No, I've got it somewhere, but I've never. I couldn't bear it. I think I started it, and oh God, he wrote this.
That's brilliant. I thought you'd be jumping on every sort of intonation, and oh, he got that wrong. He should have said it like this.
No, I think I probably would have done actually. Yeah, but I thought, oh, no.
That's the performer in you.
Maybe what we should do then is we should all listen to the talking book and then do another episode where we review it. We can see if we can get hold of Russell and get him to come on and talk about it.
Oh, no, and then you can critique him.
I wouldn't. I mean, I'm sure he's great, but yeah, I think I might have started it and gone, I can't get through this. This is too painful. You know, or why did I do that? You know.
No, don't worry. You've got the book there, and as we always do, we go through the back cover blurb. So no pressure, Dave, but the author's here, so you're going to do a good live performance.
Oh my goodness, no pressure indeed. Right, take my specs off so I can read it. Sebastien was perhaps once human. He might look like a 19th century nobleman, but in truth, he is a ruthless hunter. He likes nothing more than luring difficult opposition to a planet than hunting them down for sport. And now he's caught them all. From Zargrim, the Moogs, and even the odd Eternal. In fact, Sebastien is after only one more prize. For this trophy, he knows he's going to need help. He's brought together the finest hunters in the universe to play the most dangerous game for the deadliest quarry of them all. They are hunting for the last of the Time Lords, the Doctor. Featuring the Doctor and Donna, as played by David Tennant and Catherine Tate in a hit series on BBC Television, Fiction UK 6.99. ISBN? No, I won't go that far.
No, go that far. So, Simon, did you write that, or was that something that Justin would have come up with?
No, I wrote that, as I recall. I may be wrong, but I think I recall writing it. Justin was the editor, was he? That's really... I think he would probably have let us try and have a go and then made it better, but yeah.
It's very interesting reading the blurb back, because the thing what I found in my head after reading the back cover blurb and reading the opening sort of chapter and stuff, I thought, oh yeah, I can picture this. This is going to be like a Russell T. Davis Christmas episode with an all-star cast, and it's going to be 12 chapters of the Doctor dodging all of these hunters through various situations, and it's going to be larks and it's going to be very exciting. But it was something else entirely. It ended up being, if you like, to me at least, a sort of psychological Stephen Moffat two-parter, when it wasn't about the 12 celebrity, you know, aliens that were chasing the Doctor. It was much more of a discussion about who and what the Doctor actually is and how he operates and the authentic elements of the Doctor. So kudos, sir. You know, I was hooked. I was reeled in by the back cover blurb and given something else, a lot more food for thought instead. So where did the idea for the whole story come from?
Oh, well, I mean, you have to remember, now this is a weird book, because I hadn't written for Doctor Who for a long time, and it came absolutely, I thought I was sort of done with it all, and I completely got out of the blue, got a request from Justin to say, would you write another one? And I have to say, I hadn't actually even been watching the series, so I didn't know much about what was going on, because mitigation is I just had twin boys born, or they were on their way. So I was dealing with all of that. So I'd watched the Christopher Eccleston, and I hadn't really got that into it, I'm not going to lie. I didn't much like his Doctor. I thought, okay. I liked some of it. I liked Rob Sherman's episode. I liked Mark. I liked the Dickens one. But in general, it was like, it's on, great, you know. But I didn't much like the soap opera-y kind of element. But then when I saw David Tennant, I really, really thought he was brilliant. I thought Doctor Who was back. You know, and I may not have loved his stories, but I did think that he himself was a great Doctor in a way that I was chatting to someone the other day, and we were talking about Doctors, and that he was of my age. And he's saying, you know, the first four Doctors seemed to be the Doctor, and it was when you got to the fifth that you had the feeling that it was an actor playing the Doctor. And there was suddenly a big change in the series. And I think that is how I felt about Christopher Eccleston. He was a great actor. And David Tennant, who was the Doctor. And I don't, you know, and you know, the great thing about Doctor Who is you could dip in the bits you like and the bits you don't. But the short answer is I wasn't really that familiar with Doctor Who at this point. I got asked to do this. And as I recall, because I've been thinking about this since I knew this was coming up, that I think the first thing that got me was the idea of the double. And I quite like double stories, and I'm quite into body snatchery, as you might know. But I really liked things like Star Trek double things. But I always felt with the doubles that they all come down to basically one scene, which is the two of them standing there going, shoot him, don't shoot me. And then someone's got to choose, and then they sort of do a little giveaway so you get the right one. And I thought, what if you had, and I thought, well, no one's done it. And one of the things I really like about Doctor Who doubles is whenever they get caught, their faces fall off and you get what looks like Meccano, the little transistors from the 70s and little weird eyes that would convince no one. But somehow, you know, once you put their face on, they live and breathe and have all the memories of that person, you know. And I loved all that. But I thought, you know, you couldn't really get away with it anymore. So anyway, I knew I wanted this scene where Donna or the companion would have to choose between the two doubles. And I thought, what if the one who was the Doctor, the real Doctor, had to pretend not to be, and the one who was had to genuinely believe that they were the Doctor? Yeah. So that kind of totally complicated, you know, reversed the entire thing, you know. And Donna makes the wrong choice, and by doing that, accidentally makes the right one. I remember that was a really clear scene, and I think the rest of the book worked around that in a way.
Right.
I know there was an element of the dangerous game, the most dangerous game in it, the hunt for the Doctor. And I guess I was trying to think of something that no one else had done with the new Doctor. Well, no one's done this sort of.
Yeah.
And he was the last Time Lord, so he would be like the ultimate prize if you could bag him. So then you work back from here, who would have the balls and the ability to kind of actually set up the chase, you know?
Yeah.
I like the fact you've got Barris is the ultimate fan, pretty much, you know, sort of like being the collector, you know, the fact he gets all the surgery to look like him and everything like that, dresses like him, just think, yeah, he's just like the ultimate cosplayer, but pushed even further.
That's exactly what points. Yeah, I mean, I was wondering if it was, it seemed very before its time, a sort of a satire on how big cosplay has become as part of the whole fan experience.
Yeah, I had a Doctor Who fan in a book before. I think it was in Tomb of Valdemar, and I think he was subtly called Who Fan. I think he was a character. So I kind of liked chucking that in, because to me, Doctor Who is a lot about the fandom of it. And as you, I don't want to go off on too many tangents, but I did, when I went to my first ever convention last year in Derby, which I believe I met some familiar faces at, I was once, and it had been a long time since I'd met proper committed Doctor Who fans, and you realise that they associate with this programme in a way that is in their DNA. And I kind of vaguely remember feeling like that when I was a youth and 10 years old and buying Target books and absolutely was in love with Doctor Who, you know. But they kind of never moved out of that, or they, so I kind of felt that there would be that idea. And it's all fandom, isn't it? It's not just Doctor Who, but you know, there is somebody out there who feels it's their program and it's absolutely about them. And in a way, as a writer, I've often felt, you know, you're their property is how they feel, you know what I mean? And they've got right to say whatever they like to you. And do you know what I mean? But, you know, I didn't mean that to be negative, but I felt that you could have this character. And I liked the, I can't remember where the hunters came from, but I remember having to think up hunters and making them funny and interesting, you know, and hopefully that worked and made them all horrible, which I always like.
But yeah, there's the element of the running man to that.
Yeah. I liked that bit of it. And in a way, I kind of suppose I could have played it, like you say, David, straighter, where it just was a sort of knockabout and he has to get through. But I was too clever and I wanted to make
it worked really well. I mean, what we're saying about, for we're assuming that anyone listening has read the book. Barriss is the name of the character, is the Doctor's biggest fan, and you know, for whole chunks of the novel, I found myself questioning and thinking, is this the Doctor that's kicking about with the I must say that I'm going to get you butler joke was brilliant. The robot butler and the robot supervisor and all that stuff. And I found myself sort of thinking, is this DT? Is it Barriss? Is it Barriss who's so deep in it that he thinks he actually is? So I found myself sort of second guessing all the way through. And there's a couple of points where you kind of almost kind of lose track. Like Donna's, as you say, Donna's not entirely sure who's who, yeah, so to speak. And all that worked really, really well. And yeah, I think the thing that I found while I was reading it was, I wish I had seen on this on television, because David Tennant probably would have had the time of his life playing it, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I loved his Doctor, and I think the energy he brings through it, I really wanted to capture his energy, which I didn't really feel Christopher Eccleston had. You know, this, you know, David Tennant to me took me back to the Tom Baker era or the John Pertwee, yeah, era, where they totally own the episodes they're in and the scenes they're in, and I love that. You know, I think,
just following on from what Dave said with regards to Barriss, I absolutely agree. I think DT would have had a great time playing him, but I read Barriss's lines in a Scottish accent, as in David's natural accent, not our David, but well, I suppose both is the same accent, both from Paisley, but I just read it as being like in a Scots accent, and they'd have to put on the Tennant voice, which was quite, you know, an extra level of just, yeah, like pushing it to the next level. So you've got David Tennant playing a character who's using a Scottish voice to play an English accent, and just sort of like, that's really pushing it into meta levels. But I really,
imagine
really love
Russell
that.
Tovey having to read the audio book. You know, Yeah, I think at the time I did. I think at the time I felt that I'd gone a bit too clever, and I certainly, with when I read the you know, these books came out of two other books, the two marks, Mark Morris and Mark Mikulski, and when I read their books, I thought, oh crumbs, I've pitched this too hard at an age that is beyond who reads it now, because obviously I was quite aware that the age of the readership had gone down a little bit. But I don't think I really, and at the time I probably made this a bit too tough. But when I read it again about a month ago, I thought, actually, I don't think I have. I think, yeah, I do like that. I think you do suspect at the right time that actually these people are swapped around from what you think, you know. And I think that it felt right to me. Actually, I quite liked it, and I don't know. Yeah, it's out there now, so it's fun.
Well, yeah, it works very well. And I think, to be fair, Kenny and I have been reading a lot of the new series books to talk about on the show over the last few months. And I've, you know, without wanting to blow, you know, be too sort of like brown nosy or anything, I think...
No, go on.
I think where yours sort of... And I'm not saying the other ones failed or anything, but... They all felt quite safe. You know, Trevor's Dalek book is, as I sort of described, it was sort of Doctor Who by James Cameron, and Danny Blythe's was really, really rooted in the sort of 2008 sort of contemporary culture, satire of The Apprentice and all that sort of stuff. But yours had a real sort of, it was the one that felt the most new adventures-y, in as much as it was sort of pushing the limits and pushing the reader, but still at the same time, still feeling like proper authentic Doctor Who, still feeling like, because you know, you compare something like, you know, Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead, whatever, to a more traditional story from DT's third series, like the Sun one, and Moffat is really pushing it, but it still stays within recognisable sort of Doctor Who limits. And I think you did the same with this one. I think you should be very, own it, man, be proud of it, it's cracking. I think it's... Yeah.
Out of the, you know, the year later, the Doctor Who magazine did the three, you know, which of the three was the best, and inevitably mine was the least popular, you know. And I one of the things is it wasn't this, you know, I never really on any of my books had much communication with any other Doctor Who fans, so I was always left on my own, really. And I got to know Mark, the two Marks, quite well on this one, and really like them. But yeah, when I read their books, I thought, God, these are really like target books, you know, these are really straightforward down the line adventures, you know. And yeah, I did feel over-egged it a little bit. But, you know, when I read it again, I thought, well, actually, it stands up this book quite well. I had an entertaining read, and because it was so far away that I didn't feel I'd read it. So. And also, I kept thinking, was this going to run out of steam at some point, you know, and get a bit just painful as twist upon twist. But I didn't think it did that either, you know. I liked the bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I say it worked very well, and the thing that I liked was the way that you sort of wrote the Doctor and Donna's relationship as being sort of strained by the circumstances and all that sort of thing. Scenes with Donna trapped in the hotel, because at first I thought, right, she has been sent back to Earth, but then gradually, you know, you realise, no, it's, you know, it's not what's going on. And I liked the way you sort of put some division between the Donna and Doctor, because, you know, that, again, felt very authentic. I can imagine them doing that on TV to give Catherine and David something interesting to do, you know.
Yeah, I've met Catherine Tate a few times in Edinburgh and doing, when I was doing my sort of theatre work, so I knew her. But I didn't, obviously, when we wrote the books, they hadn't been on screen together. So we,
right,
mostly I had to drive down to Wales and watch the first three episodes, but I fell asleep through all of them. Because we were like 3 weeks old, and I'd driven all the way to Wales. I got lost. I was so tired. I got lost, and then I got there late, and then I was sort of bundled in with no refreshments into a really hot room to watch these three episodes. And the only memory I have of them is the end titles of Fires of Pompeii one, because, you know, I can't. I'm thinking, did anyone notice?
were you there yourself, or was anyone else watching them with you?
I guess the two marks would have been there, but I mean, I was so exhausted. I hadn't slept for 3 weeks, and I suddenly had to drive 200 miles to Wales.
Wow.
And then I got lost in Cardiff. And
easily done.
You know, when you're that sleep deprived, you just think, if I could just sit down for 10 minutes, I'll be able. Well, if they just given me a cup of coffee, I would have been okay. But it was very odd. You went to this studio, and there were all these sort of big brothery photos of Russell T. Davis. That's the only other thing I mainly remember. It's just like an empire. I had fun. I remember walking around the TARDIS set, and I'd woken up a bit then. But then they invited me out for a meal to the redeveloped, tortured bit of Cardiff, and I fell asleep in the restaurant. And I mean, it's hard to remember how knackered I actually was. You know what I mean? Because I had two boys, so I was feeding them at night and getting up, and I hadn't slept for weeks and weeks. And I'd really been looking forward to this because it was a way out of that routine. But it was all a bit kind of, oh, now you've got to drive home. And I was like, oh my God, you know. But I stayed over in Cardiff at a friend's house, and got to their house and went. So I should have done that the night before, really. And then I would have been.
That's amazing. I mean, that gives us an idea of how far in advance you were working, I suppose, if the episodes hadn't gone out. Because, you know, I think you got DT and CT both down pat. Would you agree, Kenny? They worked.
Completely agree. I think they're absolutely. You could read that dialogue with it. You know, just you could just read the dialogue, and you'd know exactly who it was. You wouldn't need to have the names of the characters there. It would be absolutely on the money. And just talking of characters, I thought Sebastian was a brilliant creation. Very much the sort of like the nasty sort of the villain that you're very much like the classic Who villain that you would get the likes of your Solons, you know, somebody like that who's got a very nasty manipulative edge to him. But the other thing is that he's having fun because he's so confident in his own ability. So did you have anybody in mind to play him when you were creating him?
Well, me, really, but
I'll have to be the cover.
Yeah, I did love. I mean, I think I'd always wanted. I don't, to be honest. I'm trying to work back on what I might have been thinking, but I did love. I loved films like Kind Hearts and Coronets in the Assassination Bureau, and I loved that kind of very charismatic man that would kill you as much as be your mate, you know what I mean? He'd go out for a night with you and then he'd stab you, we had a good time, you know. And I also had always wanted to do something with, there's a Michael Moorcock series about the dancers at the end of time. I don't know if you've read any of that. And it's set in the very far future on Earth. And basically humanity has evolved to, there's only about 12 people, but they're literally gods. you know, they're immortal, and they technology is, it's sort of the ultimate place where they, and they can change shape and they can do anything, and it's, but they've got no morality. And you know, and it sort of is a brilliant thing, the sequel kind of thing. They're right at the end of the existence of humanity, and they're the ultimate product. Until they keep getting time travelers who've gotten forward to, and then they kind of, you know, play around with them. But, you know, they're really like gods. And I like that kind of absolute power character, kind of killing you there. And yeah, but charming as well. I think I got a bit bored of humorless villains. And you don't exactly want him to live. I don't think he possibly would escape his fate. But, you know, I think that his own, I mean, I guess I would, I like the idea of his own arrogance trapped him.
Yeah.
Well, you know, which is a sort of classic Doctor Who theme, isn't it?
Yeah. Could we talk a little bit about the title and the concept and the idea of the Doctor Trap? No, because I found that very interesting as well. Sort of, and I've been sort of trying to, that sort of mind games aspect of dealing with people that maybe we all have in our day to day, like just be it in the workplace or what have you. I found that really interesting. The way that, for all his cleverness and stuff, Sebastian was probably overthinking and overcomplicating the fact that he wouldn't accept from the butler that they had the doctor. You know, all that, the idea of, let me get it right. It's the idea of thinking what your opponent might know, or overthinking but not really understanding what they do know. That's not it, is it? It's,
yeah, it's something like that, but it's also attributing your own sort of powers to someone else. I do remember very much, I mean, probably my favorite book is Catch 22, and
right,
I love the idea of the ironic trap in that set. And I also love the fact that it's become part of the vocabulary of life, like 1984 or the trial or something, you know what I mean? That if someone's in a 22, then you know what that means. I do suggest, I had sheer arrogance to think that I can do the Doctor Trap would be like a phrase that 22 would be, that would pass down. But I always think that was my stuff, that everyone, that anyone ever bothers to read it or maybe add it into Doctor Who canon, that it would be, you know, oh, that's a classic Doctor Trap. And I do remember thinking, if I could get that in.
Yeah.
I guess you're right, but it's quite hard to encapsulate, because obviously when I just read the book, there was about four different versions of it.
That's about when Donna's talking to someone, she says, so it's what they know but you don't know, and it's like, no, it's what they think you know about them, but you don't know it, but their doubts about what you do know about them is what makes them sort of muck up and overcomplicate it and start acting. It was very interesting. Yeah. I'm going to be honest, I'm going to start using it. Because there's a couple of folk I don't really like very much who I have to work with occasionally, and I think it's with their heads a little bit, you know? it's interesting though, because it says we're talking earlier about how comparatively adult the book was compared to, and you know, we did Ghosts of India, we loved Ghosts of India, but it was very traditional in a way that, you know, that yours kind of pushed the envelope a bit. And it's that sort of, the psychology of manipulation is fascinating, and that's why I felt this feels, you know, like a Moffat two-parter, as it were. You know, it's, in as much as it's taking the audience a little further than it would do, and it's pushing it, and you know, as Gareth Roberts always says, makes you think. You know, I found the psychological aspect of it fascinating, and that was, you know, with no disrespect to the other books that we've been covering, they hadn't given me that kind of amount of stimulation. It was all quite, this is great, this is fun. But this was like, okay, right. And I found myself thinking of work relationships or supervisors or managers I'd had in my HMV days, and sort of thinking, oh, I wish I'd read this book sooner. You know, I could have messed my head a little bit, you know.
No, I mean, it's good to hear. I mean, I think I'd reached a stage here where I recall writing it, where I'm quite a minimalist, and I was quite into stripping out as much as I could to get to that core of that sort of three-way triangle between him, Barris, and Sebastian. And everything else was kind of window dressing, and I was quite aware that I wasn't doing, you know, find what something's going on, who's behind it. There's a big monster and a big image, and it's them, you know. And I kind of felt that maybe that's why, one of the reasons, apart from its complications, that it wasn't as popular, because you couldn't go, oh, it's Doctor Who versus Sebastian. It isn't that simple, you know what I mean? And it's a bit like Doctor Who versus the Master. It's never actually happened, is it? Because visually, it's just two men. I mean, Time Lords, really. And I remember, especially Mark Michalowski's book, had a massive robot scrapyards in space and things, and you thought, well, that's brilliant. Because you can see that as a 14-year-old, I guess. You can go, oh, yeah, you're amazing. You know, and I was quite aware as a kid, I read the Han Solo books kind of came out when Star Wars first came out. They brought out a few, when there wasn't much marketing, but they brought out these Han Solo books, and you went, oh, brilliant. You know, this is going to have loads of space fighting in it. But it was actually quite dull, you know, because it didn't really work on the page.
A World's End or something like that, Han Solo World's End, something like that.
Yeah,
I remember getting them out of the library. They were so dull, I agree.
Hunter of the Main, that stuff.
Yeah, you read it, but you go, there's not... I suppose they were like novelizations of films, but they just lacked a thing, because you knew Han Solo was never going to kind of develop in the way that Doctor Who doesn't really... change. All you can do is challenge him in different ways, you know. So I don't know, really. I'm more pleased with it now than I was at the time, because I thought, oh no, I've blown it again. I've made it too hard.
Disagree. Respectfully disagree.
Yes.
Back then, with your opinion back then, I agree with you now. No, I also love the fact you got the humour into it with Butler, who's obviously, he knows exactly what's going on, but is basically just being told to shut up, I know best. And he's almost like, you can imagine him going off in a huff, you know, with the head down. Just, there's a lot of, you know, wonderful dynamics with him.
Yeah. And I, funnily enough, read it again, weirdly, I struggled to visualise the robots, and I quite liked that. I couldn't tell whether they would like, because presumably you've got the power to make them look like fantastic people. But then again, I quite like the big clanky steam coming out.
That's how I saw them.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think when I was writing it, I wasn't precise on what I could see in my head. You know what I mean? So I think that was... But yeah, in my head, they are like... I don't know, 2000 AD, ABC Warrior. It's kind of playing 70, you know.
We should do an exercise where we each draw what we think the robot is like, and then send them in, and Kenny can post them on the socials.
Yeah.
I like
that.
That
would be good. Yeah, I like that, but I think that developed. I thought, yeah. I mean, I had this sort of humorless comedy with the Hunters, who, when you drop them in and have a little cameo with them being bastards, which I kind of found quite funny, and they always end up getting wiped out because they could have avoided it if they'd just been a bit nicer.
The early scenes Hunters, I think, worked very well, because you're not entirely, especially the one I can't remember what it was called, the one where Barris is sort of, we don't quite realise exactly what's going on yet. I think it's when Barris ends up sort of having to hide down a pipe or something, I can't remember.
Down Stalingrad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, well, Nazi guy, isn't it?
Yeah. They were all really interesting, because, you know, you can imagine that being filmed in the corner of a quarry somewhere. I mean, there was enough proper Doctor Who through it, I think, you know, that it still felt, you know. Those scenes were interesting because it showed you just how much of the Doctor Barris had actually taken on.
Yeah.
You know, because he was programmed to sort of go to rescue Donna, and he was behaving and showing all the essential qualities that the Doctor would have. That was really interesting. That's why, as I said earlier, I was sort of second guessing myself all the way through. I was like, is this, you know, is it, could it really, is there going to be a, you know, a third real twist, but it turns out that it has been Barris that's been, you know, all that worked really, really well. That's
I mean, then you have to have a big cheat, don't you, with an unreliable narrator, where there's a scene that you don't see where the Doctor figures it all out and solves everything.
Yeah.
And then he's all, you know, and even I got a bit, not confused, but I got a bit, oh, is that, because I couldn't remember.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, but, you know, you have to rely on the audience trusting you and believing that there was a scene that they didn't get involved in.
Yeah.
Where
they... It's a missing chapter or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
I had form on an unreliable narrator and something pretending to be the Doctor, base eater. I think I was trying to do that again properly.
Right. Worked all very well.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's a proper page turner. I didn't want to stop reading because I just thought, just one more chapter. And you know that's an opening when I've got something that I'm enjoying, because you want to go on because you're enjoying what's going on. You want to know what happens next, and an adult book that's child friendly. I think that's probably a good way to describe it.
So what does the where did the assignment? We'd read you the contemporary Doctor Who magazine review just to see what you thought of that.
This is written by Matt Michael, who's a friend of ours. So don't worry. Here we go. Sebastian is an egomaniac who has shaped the mysterious half-legendary Planet One into his own private playground. With armies of robot servants who cater to his every whim, Sebastian wants for nothing, but he's bored. And that's why he has summoned the unsavory members of the exclusive Endangered Species Society to help him to hunt the galaxy's rarest and most dangerous game, The Last of the Time Lords. That's the hook for Simon Messingham's fast-paced and fun novel, with a plot that ducks and weaves like a man on the run and keeps the reader guessing right up until the final pages as to how it's going to pan out. The initial chapters, in which the TARDIS is stolen by an obsessive fan disguised as the Doctor, Donna is kidnapped, and the Doctor is placed into the wilds of Planet One to be hunted, are breathless and hugely entertaining, with twists that would climax other novels, such as the Doctor swapping places with his abductor, dropped in as incidental moments here and there. Donna finds herself imprisoned in a false life, as in the TV episode Forest of the Dead. But while she got a dream life in the TV episode, here she's stuck in a deserted, miserable hotel in the middle of nowhere, left to go slowly crazy. It's an awful life for someone as restless and in need of companionship as Donna. And her increasingly desperate attempts to free herself are even more poignant than the Doctor's own efforts to escape. As in Journey's End, there are two Doctors here, but one of them is an unwitting imposter, and the other has to hide his natural brilliance to prevent Sebastian from realising that he's the real deal. It's this twist that makes the book so compelling. Under normal circumstances, you feel that the Doctor would make short work of such a smug, petty villain as Sebastian. However, when the fake Doctor's life is at stake, should the switch be discovered, and with Donna being held as a hostage, things are rather more complicated. Half of the fun comes from trying to second-guess whether Sebastian has twigged the truth or not, and who is winning the game of cat and mouse. Unsurprising, then, that when given the chance, the true Doctor's vengeful side comes to the fore, as he punishes the villains for what they've done. It turns out that the fake Doctor is really just an overexcited fan called Barris, who has dreamt of escaping his own miserable life to become a part of the Doctor's world. And by becoming the Doctor for a short time, Barris transcends his roots to become something greater. That's the heart of this story, that living the Doctor's life is as good as it gets, that the last of the Time Lords really is the man that makes people better. It's a triumphant denouement, another strong novel.
Oh, superb. Well done, Matt.
I wish I'd read it at the time. I mean,
that's great. Summing up, isn't it?
Yeah, that's brilliant. It was nice to have it out there. And, I don't really much remember writing it, really, because, as I say, I was so knackered. And, as ever, Justin had asked me in the previous summer whether I'd do it, and I went, yes, but I'm having twins. In about 9 months, he commissioned me quickly, and then
this, you mentioned Justin again. Everybody always says what a great editor he is to work for,
and it was great. And he was a bit more hands-on, as I recall, but more in the initial stages, because I knew that I wasn't going to have a lot of brain power, so I structured a lot and sent him a lot of treatments, as I recall, and his notes were really good and supportive. And I felt bad because when on this fateful day that I drove to Cardiff and I got lost, I remember parking and going, is this the BBC? And I was looking at another parked car, and a man was looking at me through that car, and I was thinking, I don't know who you are, but you look like you know who I am. And I was thinking, are you Justin there? Because I didn't know who else would know me. So, yeah, I think he went, yeah, this is the BBC. Oh, I finally got it. But I found him really generous, lovely guy, let you get on with it, but he knew what he wanted. And yeah, I thought he was a great editor. I think all the editors I had have been great, but he was really very supportive, as I recall, except on giving me the contract in good time. Because I've got a rule, you know, I wasn't going to start this without absolutely 100% knowing that I was going to do it, you know, and I've got it. And they just, it just nothing to do with him, but you know, it was, I think it came, my kids were born in, it's like January the 7th or something, and I got the contract on January the 2nd. Oof. As I knew I would. And I do remember thinking about end of January, thinking I better start this because I'm going to need to write it. I've got a deadline. I remember switching my computer on, and then the next thing I remember was waking up on the floor because it had taken so long to load up that I just fallen asleep in the chair, just like laid there because I was that tired. You know, it was just.
Oh my goodness.
That's amazing. Oh.
That makes the book all the more impressive, I suppose. You were writing it under such sort of personal strain. Have your sons, have they read any of your Doctor Who books?
No.
Oh, that's terrible.
Indeed. I mean, they, you know, they're aware of the legend, but, you know. But, you know, I think kids are there.
Is that why they call you? They call you the legend, not dad?
I hope so. But I think they sometimes at school, someone will go, your dad writes Doctor Who books. And they go, oh right, yeah,
you know, get them to read Strange England before they get any older and they'll mess them up a bit. It'll do, yeah. It'll do good.
Yeah, so
even just the bit with the tree. Oh, that's stuck in my head for 30 years. It's brilliant. Anyway,
we'll come back to that another day. We'll come back to that.
Yeah, that was the evolution from body horror to a comedy of manners, which is this one. And there was one after this as well, wasn't there? And it was the Troll Under the Bridge one.
Yes, which I have actually got on my phone to listen to because when I'm driving later on today. So
again,
we'll come back to that another day.
Hopefully get you back on, talk about your other books at some point. I'm really keen to talk about Indestructible Man at some point as a big shit fan. There was a contemporary review of that, which I'd love to try and track down and read out, just so we can all collectively bang our heads against the wall. We'll save that for another time.
Absolutely. So, Simon, of course, you've been working on something of interest, which I think will appeal to cult TV fans of late, because I'm sure that anybody who's read the back cover of the new adventure Nightshade will be familiar with the name The Teen People. So can you tell us what that is and its 21st century incarnation?
Yes, well, indeed. The Teen People is a play that I wrote with Mark Gatiss in Leeds in 1988. And we were on the dole and had nothing at all, literally, you know, living in starvation level. But we wrote this play, which is a spoof of The Tomorrow People in some respects. But it's actually a spoof of all 70s telly science fiction, really, completely. And it's a very silly play in its own right. And we'd been to the Edinburgh Festival and we'd seen a James Bond spoof. And we'd also been involved in a sort of glam rock spoof, which we didn't like at the time, but I kind of like now a lot. But so we thought, well, you can write this kind of stuff and you can perform it and no one says anything. So we went, let's do something. Yes, we wrote it, and then because we were all on the dole, we found some other people on the dole, and we rehearsed it for 6 months because we had nothing else to do. And then I hit all the bars in Leeds and looked for venues to play, and then eventually got someone to put us on. And we ended up doing the show for loads and loads of years, up till about 1993, I think, was the last time we did it. And we did it in London, we did it in Edinburgh, we had all sorts of guest stars in it, and it was just loads and loads of fun. And then obviously, yeah, we moved apart and nothing happened. And then, yeah, in 2017, I thought, I'll do it again just to see if I can do it. And it was a sort of 25th anniversary. So I didn't have a script. So I had a DVD of a performance in 1990 in Leeds. So I watched that and I had to transcribe the script off that telly version. because obviously we all had handwritten the script, I think, originally. We knew it so well that we didn't bother with the script. So, yeah, and I revived it, and I got some money to revive that in down in Sussex. And we did it then. And then I thought, well, we could do more with this. And I had the idea, and I had a bunch of old scripts that had never been commissioned. So I thought, well, you know what, they're either going to sit and die, or I can do something with them. And I thought, I got to know Alistair Locke, who does a lot of work for Blake 7 Audios, I think, now. And he'd had some history of Doctor Who, quite a big history, I think. Got on pretty well with him, and he's a genius at production. And so, yeah, we did an audio. We've done, basically, the short story is, we've done a two-part audio version of the story. I've rewritten the story quite considerably. I don't know what Mark's involvement. I have a feeling Mark might have done it again with somebody, or someone had asked him whether they could put it on, because I remember him asking if I'd mind. Obviously not. But yeah, so we've got this, and it's coming out quite soon, in years to make it. But yeah, it's about to be launched with a load of other old scripts with similar sort of style. And yeah, that's what I've been doing with my time this year.
Well, why don't we hear a quick trailer now?
Introducing the Teen People. John.
We are the Teen People, members of a super secret space organization, the teenage elite of the English nation.
Jenny.
Sometimes I tire of all of this.
Mending fences.
All of this. This flitting about through time, space, this super space powering. I yearn to be normal.
Tizer.
You've got to take me as you finds me. It's because I ain't got no mum and dad, see?
I know!
I'm going to stick you one!
Together with their computer brain, Felch.
I am an advanced space computer bank.
They face a global threat as...
Pants are coming down all over the world.
That's not a real message and you know it.
You must wear them. Obey your pants.
Blimey, even he's wearing a pair.
Oh my God, they're pink.
What the devil? Pants!
What?
Pants! 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 Pants!
Of course.
It's another job for...
The Teen People.
Right.
Yes, the Teen People. Coming soon or here already. One or the other, or both.
It was horrible. Horrible. Horrible, I tell you.
I have to say, I have listened to the trailer and the extra scene that you sent me as well 3 times, and I am laughing all the way because all the Tomorrow People things that you could pastiche are in there perfectly. They're just done brilliantly to the Tizer. Yeah. And yeah, the fact is that an older fella, I mean, I think what would make it even funnier would be for you to do it live on stage now playing a teenager, because obviously John was never a teenager when Tomorrow People was on. And I think that would make it even funnier. But
yeah, well, I did play him on in the revival that we did, but we sold out. You know, we had a really big crowd, I think, because of Mark's name. And I didn't play John originally, Mark did. So it was my chance to step in and do the lead, which I've been waiting my whole life to do. Yep. So yeah, I played the lead on this one, which it's just really, yeah, I mean, Alistair's just working with him has just given it a whole new life on audio, because a lot of the jokes in it are visual, which is really difficult. So I've had to... It was fun. I made them into audio gags, you know, and there's a lot in that scene that I've sent, and in the trailer. He's just brilliant. And because Alistair's got the mindset of that, he knows exactly the tone and how to do it, and his timing is unbelievable. So, yeah, hopefully this is going to kind of kick off. I'm not, you know, embarrassed to say that obviously having Mark Gatiss's name on it doesn't hurt the chances of it being listened to, you know, but at the end of the day, it's just funny, hopefully. And yeah, we're doing them as sort of podcast, so we're having the episode but also chats around it and introductions, and I get interviewed by a professional podcaster and we talk about the story, and the woman who interviewed me, Megan, is a lot younger than me, and she was saying, you know, it's all about 70s nostalgia, but she's saying, well, there's now 90s nostalgia, so when, of course, we did the show, you know, when we were doing the show about that, you know, so there's lots of weird, but it stands up, you know. I mean, I've had to rewrite the end and rewrite quite a lot of it because it was quite dated, because the end, the plot is about the death of, well, British television. And you go, well, it's died, you know, it's gone. And, right. You know, we never predicted that, that television itself would evolve so much that it's essentially stopped, you know, the idea that everyone would watch a channel. Yeah, it never occurred to us that there would never, that would not be ever something that is always there, you know, but of course it's totally gone now. And
it's fantastic. So when are we hoping this will be available? Because I know that I'm desperate to hear more, because Dave, I've sent you the clips. I don't know if you've had the chance to hear them yet.
I haven't yet. I still have my Weetabix when you sent them through.
Oh my God. I was hoping they would launch end of January, and it's still not launched yet. But there you go. But basically, it's a big website with a load of podcasts on it. Well, they're not really podcasts, but, you know, they're as good as
audio content. Which also, I love the fact you're interviewed by a professional podcaster, whereas these two unprofessionals, we are quite happy with our status. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't casting any aspersions, but. I loved it. But yeah, so there's a web, basically I've got a website, it's all ready to rock, but we're just getting, you know, because I'm doing everything, and with Alistair, everything takes a long time, and these are quite complicated audios with loads and loads of editing in, because, you know, it sounds smooth, but to get that timing it's taken quite a while. And so I'm hoping, and also I have no digital skills, which doesn't help, but the website will be out. I've been paying for it for 3 months, but it is.
Well, we will, of course, push it through all our social media and personal pages as well.
We'll boost it and all that, definitely. Most
definitely will.
And hopefully it'll be reciprocal. We can kind of all collab, as I heard, with an abbreviation that we have to use now.
Yeah, we do. That is cool. It's like all the kids do, you know, content creators. That's what we are. That's what you've got to regard yourself now. You're not a writer, you're a content creator.
I put a funny comment on the social media the day again. Well, someone said they wanted to collab with me, and I got all snooty about that. And then someone went, oh, well, we can tell that you don't go on Instagram there, granddad.
Okay, boomer.
But the people of my age went, oh yeah, who would use that abbreviation? Oh.
Well, it happens, and I've got a friend, one of my former colleagues from HMV. She has her own sort of clothing sort of business, you know, she's a seamstress basically making swimwear, and she was sort of collabing with someone who was who wore one of her bathing suits to Coachella the other weekend, you know. And that's what Sharon said, you know. I was asked her about, you know, about collabing. She didn't say collaborating, she said collabing. It's the right, cool, you know.
I think it's the way to separate the old from the new.
It's all about content. My days are just filled with maintaining the evergreen content pipeline that is the Instagram of the Earth 2 podcast, just so that we keep it going.
No, but I mean, I think you guys, I mean, you're totally inspired by being in your podcast. I've had no experience of it until I did the first one with you guys, and then I went, well, actually, I completely give you credit for that. It was the genesis of the Daleks of my website.
That's good to know. We'll take full credit then. That's great.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was such fun. I didn't realize. I thought it would be like a grim slog, but it was such fun. I mean, designing a website with no knowledge isn't fun.
Right. No, I can testify to that.
I think your unexpected cameo in our Fifth Doctor episode last year was the real catalyst, wasn't it?
It was the phone call extra bit at the end.
Yeah.
It was glorious.
Yeah, we've never done that before or since.
That was the only one who was available. All the others were too successful. They wouldn't pick.
I just remember Kenny reading out your text, sort of saying, I'm just putting the shopping away. Give me 5 minutes. Oh, dear. Live podcasting.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's brilliant. No, and I've thoroughly enjoyed this latest collab, Simon. Really, really enjoyed it. And
excellent.
We really have to. We've got to go and do the Indestructible Man in our next run. No questions at all.
Oh, wow. I'd have to read that. That seems to be a very hard to find book for some reason. So,
Yeah. Well, we've all got it, so that's
supposed to be the interest in the Gerry Anderson fans as well, but we'll talk about all that when we cover it. Cool. Simon, at the end of each episode, Kenny likes to kind of risk a copyright strike by playing out with a tune. Is there a song you'd like to nominate for us to play out with today that you think maybe suits the Doctor Trap or anything?
Not
on the spot or anything.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I was just thinking, given what you were saying...
Our friends are electric. Yeah,
that would work. That works. For all the robots and all that, that'll do.
Yeah, I love
Perfect.
That.
Perfect. That's like Gary Newman.
Cool. Simon, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been absolutely wonderful. I love it. Yeah. I could live like this all the time.
So could we. Sad that we do. Can. Well, we do. Okay. All right. Dave, don't tell the real world.
Yeah, it's better than working, isn't it?
So. Yeah.
Definitely is. You know, Simon, thank you. It's been really great fun. And we shall see you very soon. And let's hand over to Mr. Newman.
We'll see you tomorrow, folks.
No pressure, Dave, but the author's here, so you're going to do a good live performance.
Oh, my goodness. No pressure, indeed. Right. Take my specs off so I can read it. Sebastian was perhaps... Right, I'll start that again. That's a good... There we go. Right, the first... I'll start swearing in a second. That's my first edit point of the day. First of many.